Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The government has now been partially shut down for more than 8% of a year. Just thought we'd put that one out there. Also, 2 years into his term, what are your top 10 Trumpian economic moments? We've got a list from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 22nd of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here with a statement of fact on day 32 of the government of the United States being not entirely open for business. The longer this thing goes on, the worse it is for the economy, the worse it is for businesses that rely on those unpaid government workers, and the worse it is for those workers, many of whom are being forced to seek leniency from their creditors and have turned to food banks. Kraft Foods, in point of fact, took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post over the weekend. It hopes for an end to the shutdown, of course. And, oh, by the way, it called attention to a grocery store with free food for federal workers that it just opened in D.C. Really, it's Exhibit A of the challenge a lot of brands are facing right now, marketing themselves in the middle of this shutdown. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off in Washington.
Here in D.C., there are shutdown specials everywhere. Discounts for federal workers at bars and restaurants, cash giveaways on the radio to help people pay their bills. And watching TV this weekend?
The Hyundai Elantra and Sonata.
What seemed to be a typical car ad had a shutdown offer tacked on the end, a $500 rebate for affected federal workers.
So you'll see local advertisers modifying existing advertising to speak directly to audiences that could be affected by the shutdown.
Jason D'Amata is an analyst with media consulting firm TV Rev. He says certain industries view the shutdown as an opportunity.
You're seeing these debt collection and, you know, short-term loan, and you're seeing TV advertising targeting people who might be cash-strapped, really focused in on local areas.
Especially local areas with lots of government workers. But big brands, household names, have to be cautious, says Joseph Watson Jr., a public affairs professor at the University of Georgia. With the shutdown so politically fraught, a stalemate between Democrats and Republicans,
you have to be careful that you structure messaging in a way that doesn't appear to be politically aligned with either of those factions.
At the same time,
you look at it as kind of a good opportunity there to brand yourself favorably as kind of a white knight who's helping the beleaguered federal employees.
And while everyone waits on Washington to come up with a deal, businesses have to find a way to strike the right marketing balance. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Here with another statement of fact on day 32, Congress and the White House are really, really lucky this whole thing is happening when the economy is doing really well. But for some businesses, not those household names that Kimberly was just talking about, but for smaller businesses, the shutdown economic margin of error is pretty thin. Marketplace's Janet Babin has that one.
The Hot Grill at Bub and Pop's restaurant in Washington, D.C. was welcome relief for customers coming in from the freezing cold. But the lunch crowd was thin. It's been getting worse every day since the shutdown began, says co-owner Arlene Wagner.
We would have at least 10 to 15 people in line, and as you can see, there's only 3 people waiting at the counter.
Even for a holiday, business was so slow yesterday that Wagner closed early. But Wagner says she's trying to keep normal hours.
I'm reviewing every bill that we get in to see what could we not pay now.
But if there's no change, Wagner may have to let some employees go. She says business is off by about 25%. And since the restaurant industry often operates on single-digit margins, that's a big deal, says David Henkes with research and consulting company Technomic.
And when you have this situation where, you know, weather and government shutdowns and all of these things are impacting, it's just a whammy to their bottom line that some of them may not recover from.
And it's not just D.C. Any eatery near a federal office complex is at risk from these pressures, even an iconic Harlem fixture like Melba's, where patrons get their fix of fried catfish and eggnog waffles. Owner Melba Wilson says her business is down 20% since the shutdown began. She served free lunches today for federal employees. She knows it won't solve all their problems, but
I felt that I had to do something. And being from the South and my family being from Harlem, we do everything over food.
Chances are the furloughed workers getting a free meal today will remember Melba's once they go back to work. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We're going to stick with the shutdown theme we've got going here as a way to get into a segment we're doing this week, just past the halfway mark of his term, a segment about Donald Trump's presidency and how much as he has done with the political conversation in this country, the president has changed the way we talk about business and the economy. He does it in tweets, he does it in speeches, and he does it in off-the-cuff remarks. We asked some of our regulars to contribute as well, the folks you hear on Fridays talking about the economic week gone by, and we're going to do it online as well, marketplace.org. There have been a lot of Trumpian economic moments the past couple of years. We settled on 10 because you got to draw the line someplace, though. A tip of the hat first, though, to the Atlantic magazine and its list that came out a week or so ago. 50 moments, this is their headline, 50 moments that define an improbable presidency. So, with that as background, this note. President Trump started changing our economic conversation really even before he was elected.
And Mexico will pay for the wall.
Everybody knew during the campaign that Mexico wasn't going to pay for the wall. Mexico said it was not going to pay for the wall. So the president, in the 2 years he has been in office, has been moving the goalposts on who is going to pay until just after New Year's this year, he got to this tweet.
I often said during rallies with little variation that Mexico will pay for the wall. We have just signed a great new trade deal with Mexico. It is billions of dollars a year better than the very bad NAFTA deal, which it replaces. The difference pays for wall many times over.
The president has said similar things in different venues, but there are just a couple of problems with the president's new payment plan for his wall. First of all, the new NAFTA, the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canadian agreement, hasn't been ratified yet, so it's not in effect, so it's not paying for anything. Also, there aren't any new tariffs in the USMCA, so there is no new tariff revenue coming in. And finally, and one hates to belabor a point that the government shutdown is making clear every day, but Congress controls the purse strings. So even if or when new tariff money from the new NAFTA starts coming in, Congress will decide how it gets spent. That is the actual economic conversation in this country. There are more than a couple of Trumpian economic moments devoted to trade on our list. They are coming up later this week. But trade was the decider on Wall Street. Today, reports the White House has broken off talks with China, drove everything down a whole lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll stipulate here that taxes are complicated. We will also stipulate that this year's returns might be a bit more complicated than most because of the changes brought about by the 2017 tax law. That said, the Internal Revenue Service has released its final rules on a key tax break some businesses are going to be interested in using this year, what's called the pass-through deduction, up to 20% for certain kinds of companies. Which certain kinds of companies? We got our tax reporter, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra, on the phone from New York to clear things up. Hey, Mariel.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So give me the background on this thing, first of all, would you? We have talked a lot about corporate tax cuts that were in this bill. This is not what that is.
Right. So the new tax law cut taxes for corporations from 35% to 21%. But most businesses in the U.S. actually don't pay the corporate tax rate, believe it or not. You know, LLCs, partnerships, S corporations, they are what's known as pass-through businesses. Basically, the money they make, their business income, passes right on through to their owner's individual tax return. And so their business is taxed at the owner's personal income tax rate. So when Congress was writing this tax law, yeah, it came up with a tax break for these kinds of businesses, too. And it basically says they can deduct up to 20% off their income when they do their taxes. Beyond that, though, things got pretty confusing.
Well, explain that a little bit, because I'm mostly with you, but what's the confusing part?
So the IRS, when there's a new tax law, it will come out with rules, regulations, mm-hmm. basically, here's whether or not you qualify, that sort of thing. it did that for this deduction. But the rules are really complicated. They are intended to keep people from abusing the deduction. So they were more than 180 pages long, and they're filled with caveats. Like, there's a list of industries that do not qualify for the tax break: accounting, performing arts, athletics, health. But after that, there are a lot of questions from businesses and their accountants about whether they fell into these categories. So, like, I talked to a business owner named Carol. She owns a nursing home in North Carolina. She really wants the tax break. Her accountant said it could save her about 8 cents for every dollar she makes. Yeah. But they didn't know whether she qualified, because remember that list of industries, the healthcare is on it. But is a nursing home a healthcare business? You know, she's got nurses on staff, but she also provides housing and food and activities like bingo night. So it was sort of up in the air for them.
Can I, and this is just hypothetical, and get your financial and tax advice elsewhere, of course, but can I step back from this job, reincorporate myself as Acme Radio Host LLC, and then get some kind of pass-through from American Public Media and Marketplace?
You know, that's exactly what these rules were trying to prevent.
I know.
I think, again, get your tax advice elsewhere, but I don't believe that you personally could do that.
Right.
But you would probably fall into one of those excluded categories. But yeah, I mean, that's why they put all these rules in place.
So this kind of ambiguity, just on the way out here, right? It seems to not be entirely normal, right? We've had the same tax code for 30 years and people had it pretty much wired.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of normal, actually. I talked to some accountants and tax experts about this. The IRS is always coming out with rules, about new pieces of tax legislation. And there are, you know, I think it's something like 160 million individual taxpayers. The IRS can't come up with rules that answer every question somebody might have. And so the agency gives a certain amount of clarity, and then accountants and tax lawyers make a judgment call. This happens all the time. And eventually it's decided through audits and court cases.
And then this tax filing season starts now in like 10 days, 2 weeks, right?
Oh, yeah. It actually starts, I think, in 6 days.
6 days. There you go. I need to call my accountant. Mariel Segarra on the Tax Beat for us in New York. Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Talk to you soon. Our second Trumpian economic moment came to us in this tweet. It was June the 1st of last year. It was a Friday. The president talking about the May jobs report, which was due out about an hour after he tweeted this.
Looking forward to seeing the employment numbers at 8:30 this morning.
That was a tweet that was read by mostly, everybody, as the president giving a hint that the jobs report was going to be good. That is not part of our normal economic conversation. So we asked one of our Friday regulars, Neela Richardson, she's an investment strategist at Edward Jones, for her take.
When the president tweeted how great the economy was in advance of the actual numbers in the labor market being released, it was eye-opening and surprising to me, to say the least. And that's because I know that that process is very secure and it's painstakingly careful to make sure that no one gets advanced information. That information can move markets. But I have to say, it did renew my faith and trust on the civil servants who put out that data. It's the process that gives credibility to the data. And so by the time that number reached the White House or the Fed or any other spokesperson or leader, that number had been baked in. It had been rigorously analyzed and put forward. And so there was no one who's going to alter that number because of the process. I guess going forward, you see that in every single agency, that independence and autonomy when it comes to data. You see it in the CBO when it comes to the deficit and their projections. You see it in the Fed when they're talking about the independence from the White House or from Congress and politics in general. The credibility of our institutions is largely built on the credibility of our data. And again, that's independent of whoever holds the office of the president.
Just because we happen to have a real life example of how economic data conversations are supposed to go in our files, here it is, me talking to Fed Chair Jay Powell one morning this past July. Let me ask you then about inflation and about prices, which are, as you say, starting to tick up to where the Federal Reserve wants it to be. I'll note here that we're talking at 8:24 in the morning on the day the consumer prices come out, and they come out in 6 minutes, with the caveat that this is going to air now in 5-6 hours from now, whatever it is. You have the number in your back pocket. You know what the number is. Inflation, CPI?
Well, let's just say that I do get a look in advance at these things, yes.
You're not going to tell me what it is, even though
definitely
we're not
going
to air this until...
Definitely right, not.
Well, score one for the chairman's adherence to the rules.
Not going to say good. Anything that would suggest what it might be.
Absolutely fair enough. Trumpian economic moment number 3 of 10, coming up in a bit. Coming up,
people entering the workforce has a real personal cost that's never measured in any of the reports.
When the costs of unemployment do get kind of personal, but first, sure, let's do the numbers. I expected the Wawas. Honestly, I did. The Dow Industrial is off 301 points today, 1.2%, 24,404, down like 450 at one point the blue chips were. NASDAQ shed 136 points, 1.9%, 27,020. S&P 500 lost 37 points, about 1.4%, 26,032 there. Halliburton dropped 3%. Today, the oilfield services company beat analyst expectations in the fourth quarter. Also, though, lowered first quarter revenue in some key areas, including because of, oh, by the way, reduced fuel demand from China. Schlumberger off 1.7%. Helmrich & Payne drilled down 3.9%. Healthcare giant Johnson & Johnson gave back 1.4%. Today, bond prices, thanks for asking, they rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace has a mission that drives what we do every day, to increase economic intelligence across the country. But we can't do it alone. So please, become a Marketplace investor today in whatever amount you choose, and your donation will go twice as far thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not great news for Google out of France yesterday. The search company that's really an advertising and data company has been hit with a $57 million fine for failing to be transparent about privacy guidelines. It's the first time an individual European Union country has invoked the General Data Protection Regulation, if you remember that, and went into effect last year. Anyway, in absolute terms, $57 million is a boatload of money. For Google, though, $57 million is a vanishingly small fraction of a boatload. So, Marketplace's Andy Euler looked into what kind of fine might actually get a company like that to pay attention.
For a bit of perspective, let's say you earn an annual salary of $50,000. The fine Google's been asked to pay is the equivalent of $25.
Google loses that kind of change in the laundry every month.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and is author of books that have been critical of Google and Facebook. He says a couple of things need to happen to make these punishments more effective.
One, the fine should be in the billions and not the millions. But beyond that, we really need a regulatory structure that takes the problems of the abuse of personal data seriously.
Vaidyanathan says part of the problem is that it's not just Google and Facebook whose businesses stand to lose from stricter data regulation. AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast are all in the same boat. Their business models are also based on obtaining and selling your data. So all of those companies, Google included, have an interest in making sure regulations don't adversely affect their bottom lines. Joel Richard Paul teaches law at the University of California, Hastings in San Francisco. He says these companies make so much money from user data that
until fines get high enough, they're unlikely to have an incentive to change that business model.
But he says there's another factor at play, even when a fine is relatively small.
That's really the reputational damage.
Paul says this European fine could act as a signal to consumers that what these companies are doing isn't good. And Google, Facebook, and others are more worried about losing users and their data than they are about fines. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A quick follow-up now to our story last week about mobile payments in the Chinese economy. Some of you had a hard time believing something that our Shanghai correspondent Jennifer Pak said. Here's the part I'm talking about.
Mobile payment has exploded in China, way more than in the U.S. Americans use mobile payment for more than $100 billion worth of transactions in 2016. But that same year in China, we're talking about $23 trillion.
Your objections went like this, basically. China's GDP that year, 2016, wasn't even $12 trillion. How can mobile payments be nearly twice that? Not only can they? It turns out we actually underreported the dollar amount of mobile transactions in China in 2016. Jennifer has the explanation at marketplace.org. Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, by the way, how about a little taste of global economic elitism with your morning coffee? How about that? The World Economic Forum in Davos is on. Last Friday, the White House announced President Trump is going to meet with Kim Jong-un late next month. Details still TBD. It'll be their second meeting, and it is our third moment of Donald Trump changing the way our economic conversation happens. Back we go to a moment in Singapore last year. The president, after his first summit with the North Korean leader, talking about North Korea's economic upside.
As an example, they have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained, I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective. You have South Korea, you have China, and they own the land in the middle. How bad is that, right? It's great.
Part of what the president has done to the national economic conversation here, part of why he won, arguably, is that he is framing that conversation through his transactional background as a businessman and a deal maker and a guy who made his money in real estate, like hotels. As I said up at the top of the program, we picked 10 moments. We're going to roll out the rest this week. You can check our interactive list in the meanwhile. It's at marketplace.org. January jobs report is going to be here in 10 days. The Bureau of Labor Statistics assures us it is still coming, by the way. So we're going to have some data to chew on as we try to figure out exactly how the shutdown is affecting this economy. We're going to back up to the December unemployment number, though. A lot of new jobs, more people getting back into the workforce, if you remember. We're going to use it to set up today's installment of our series, My Economy, our snapshots of how people are getting by out there.
I'm Javier Cobo, and I do marketing for a tech startup in Washington, D.C. When the jobs report came out, it seemed to be all sunshine and everything was great news. Unemployment was up, but that's because there were so many more job seekers in the market. And they didn't really touch on why those people were entering the market again. In my world, I know that my mom has re-entered the job force kind of unhappily. She's working as a cashier at a retailer. It's not because she wants to be working, but because she can't make ends meet. And so she has to have a job now in her retirement as she approaches 70 to just be able to pay the bills and try to keep up with medical expenses. She has to constantly be on her feet. And as somebody that's getting older, it can be really hard on her. On the one hand, I feel really blessed right now in that I have a job that I love. I'm making good money. And I'm able to strive towards a lot of the goals that I have in life. At the same time, I have massive student loan debt, and it's really unclear what my parents' expenses are. I try to do my part. I pay for their cell phone and help them with their cable bill, but when it comes to things like giant dental expenses or ongoing pharmacy costs, it's really something that I can't plan for. At the same time, it's this really ginger exchange because she feels uncomfortable and maybe a little ashamed about her situation, and it's hard for a child to be telling his parent what to do. I think that what the jobs report doesn't communicate is all of the personal losses that are coming from having to be in a situation where you're looking for a job. People entering the workforce has a real personal cost that's never measured in any of the reports.
This series doesn't work without your stories, right? Tell us how your economy is doing at marketplace.org. final note on the way out today, a quick follow-up to Javier Cobo's story that you just heard. For those who have been wondering, by which I mean mostly economic journalists probably, how the shutdown is going to mess with the January unemployment report, well, it turns out not all that much. The Bureau of Labor Statistics put out a fact sheet today in which it said federal government employees who are working but who will not be paid until funding is available are included in employment counts. Furloughed federal employees who are not working are also going to be included in employee counts because they're going to get paid later. Federal contractors, well, they're not being paid, so they are not counted as employed. And we are out of here. The Dow off 301 points today, 1.2%. NASDAQ down 136, 1.9%. The S&P 500 off 37, about 1.4%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Byun, Daniel Chiriguayo, Joanna Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Tatar Nieves is the executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.